Hello, my name is Jacob Davis, and welcome to my podcast interview with Tuta Theater Chicago founding director Jelko Jukic and actor Jeffrey Binder. What we're talking about today is the show that Jelko directed called Music Hall by Jean-Luc Lagarce, which is currently playing at the Den Theater. It's a great show. I highly recommended it in my review for ChicagoCritic.com. And Jelko, would you like to begin by telling, or Jeffrey, would you like to begin by telling us a little bit just about what this play is about, and then we'll move on from there.
Okay. Well, it's about a, it's about an artiste, a diva, who is, and it's, I guess in the simplest way, it's a diva who's traveling around, performing a show that she's done for many, many years. And
you play the diva.
I do. I do play the diva. And she's entered into her middle age, and she had some success, and that success has started pretty much faded. And it's kind of almost a cabaret piece about her performing, but also about her life, but also about the people that she's performing with. It's just a kind of a theatrical event about this artiste. You could probably fill in the blanks a little bit better than I can.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those pieces where the story is not in foreground, and it's more in a meditation on certain subjects. And I think in this case, the theme is really the theme of the play is the life and career of an artist in any kind of artist, not just in this case, it's an actress, but it's simply a situation that life brings to anybody who is trying to stay true and faithful to his calling, or her in this case.
And I agree with that. That's certainly the play that I saw. And the way that it's structured is that it's not so much a story, but it's a recollection of an experience that has happened many times over the career of the artiste and her two. Well, we see two of apparently many actors she's worked with
right.
over the years.
Yeah.
During rehearsals, we actually found it's a memory play. And then we played with that idea of how to reconstruct the life and career of this imaginary artist that actually is really reflecting everybody's experience, more or less.
And why don't you talk to me about the rehearsal process? Because I think it must be difficult as an actor or director to be able to tell a story but also live in that story as you're recounting it, which is what is happening for a great deal of the play. And I was wondering if there is any insight you could provide us into how you handled that or anything else that you found interesting about this particular form.
Well, it's an interesting piece in that most of it is basically a monologue. Most of it's in monologue form, and it's an interaction with the audience. So the most difficult part about rehearsing a piece like this is that you're engaged with a character, and that character is the audience, and they're not there until maybe a day or two before you open. So mostly we just kind of went into various directions and tried various, we didn't know exactly what it was going to be, and really what the style was actually going to take, so we just played a lot. We really took it in as many directions as we could. We were running around a lot. We had a lot of extra blocking. We had a lot of extra things that we added, and then every time we would get in front of, let's say some of the Tuta people would come and see a rehearsal, or they would see a read through. The more we worked on it, the more we realized that the simpler we made it, and the more we focused on just simply talking to the audience, the more we focused on the text, the better it was, the more it resonated. And so then the second half of the process was mostly paring it down. And in the meantime, it's a very difficult script to learn because Ligaris is cyclical in his writing. There's a ton of repetition. Mm-hmm. But the repetition has meaning, and it means something different every time that you say it. So the idea is that you're trying to commit this thing to memory, but it has to have an ease and a flow to it as if it's conversational. So you have to find the depth of what she's saying and why when she's saying it this time it means something different than when she said the exact same thing last time. And that was the big biggest challenge for me, I would say. What about you?
Well, Lagarce is a fascinating playwright and visionary in many sense, unique, and although coming from tradition of being French of UNESCO and Beckett, and a theater that is not taking a story as its basis, but more a theater as an event, mm-hmm. and where the language is really not just means of communication, but really a sort of a energy and entity of its own. So just following that, trusting the writer, and really try to kind of find what's hidden behind his language and the characters was our guide, into finding, illuminating, I should say, these beautiful situations that everybody can recognize. So, in one hand, you have language that's very almost, when you read the play, impenetrable. But once an actor starts speaking it and playing with that, it becomes very clear and very beautiful in a
alive.
Sense, and very alive. Yeah.
And I should point out that this is the first time that Music Hall has been produced in the United States, I think, and that Jelko has also directed two previous plays by Lagarce that were also the first time those have been performed here. And my understanding is that Lagarce died in 1995, and he's become popular in Europe since then, but is still just starting to get known in the United States. And I was wondering if you could tell us what it is about his writing specifically that you're attracted to?
First of all, it's absence of any cliches and any devices that are obscuring a real craft of mm-hmm. playwriting. I mean, he really, like being a visionary writer, he really does not manipulate neither actors nor audience, and speaks about things that are essential, that are urgent, that are relevant and important, and says it in such a way that is really open for interpretation. So there is no dogma in it. There is no prescriptions of how life should be lived or how human relationships should be organized and arranged. It's simply a certain sense of urgency of living, I think, that he captured, that fascinates me from the moment I first read his writing. I think it's an important playwright whose time is coming not outside of France too, and that as we go, he'll be more important for theater and for the development of modern theater. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think when you look at the writing on the page, when you first read it, it's what Jake was saying. It's impenetrable. You're just looking at it, going, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But once you speak it, there's just a profound understanding of the artist and the artist's journey in this play particularly, and on top of it this sense of mortality, mm-hmm. which I think he wrote a lot. He wrote when he knew that he was going to die. And there is just this sense of time and this urgency of expression mixed with the idea that it's coming to an end. That this person, whether it's the artist's kind of career or life or something, is coming to an end. This need to speak the truth about her experience. And once you start speaking that, the text that he's written, it opens it up. It opens up that quest, I guess, to the essence of the artist that I think resonates whether you're an actor, you know, whether you're an actor, dancer, singer, anybody that's in the arts. I think it really, the things that she described, the things that she's gone through, the people that she's met, the audiences that she's encountered, all of these things are things that any artist will find connection to. Mm-hmm. And mixed with that quest of like, why am I, like, why do we do this? What is this? What is this about? This brief time that we have, like, what is this drive that the artiste and her two sidekicks, mm-hmm, have about this process, this need to be, to perform. Right.
Yeah, and it's also a kind of writing which is not linear in a sense that it narrates something that is sequential in chronological. The text has a musical quality almost.
Yes, that's true.
That an actor really can explore, not just because of its content value, but its formal value, rhythmical value, and I think what Jeff does wonderfully, as well as two other actors, Michael Doonan and Darren Hill, is just this enormous range of what can an actor do with a piece of text like that. You see, I think, craft of acting completely exposed and used in material like that.
And there is a strong musical element in this play because we do have actors playing on a harmonica. We have this sort of folk music, and I think that you did succeed in bringing out that dimension in the production that you can't hear in the text. So this production is going to New York City. It's going to be in an off-Broadway theater, and Jeff is from New York. And I was wondering if you could tell us how the two of you started working together on this. I think you had worked together before. If you could tell me about that, because this is an unusual casting choice to have Jeff in this role, although maybe not. This is the first time it's been performed in the U.S.
Yeah, we did work a long time ago, actually, where my first professional production in this country when I moved in here in the early 90s was a Serbian play that I translated called Radovan III, and Jeff, as a young actor, and me as a young director, we went to the same school, University of Maryland College Park. We knew of each other's work, school work, but then we got opportunity to do something together outside of the school, and that was my actually first production, which did decently, not bad,
yeah.
I would say. But then we've never really worked since Jeff moved to New York. I moved to Chicago, and
I went off to grad school to NYU. So that was the year after we worked on that project.
Yes.
And you stayed in D.C. for another couple of years. And founded Tuta there, right?
Yeah, Tuta was incepted in D.C.
So, you know, we went our separate ways, but we always kept in touch. I've always admired Jaco's work, and whenever I had the chance to see it, I mean, you brought
Rules for Good Manners
to New York, so I got a chance to see that. And we'd always kept in touch because, you know, it's, as I'm sure you know, when you have an opportunity to work with somebody who you think has a profound understanding of theater and is an artist in theater, it's always exciting to see to see what they're doing and to talk to them about it. It kind of reignites the flame as to why you go into it. You know, a lot of times when you're a professional actor, you know, you're fighting to get paid. You know, you're doing two lines on Law and Order SVU or whatever. But there isn't. You spend a lot of time in school working on the craft of being a theatrical artist, and there are very few directors where you have a chance to bring that artistry to bear, where you really are challenged to bring something to the stage that's truthful, but also theatrical. That lives in the theater, that exists. That the theater is the medium where it can only be expressed, and a play like this is wholly theatrical. It's a wholly theatrical event. It lives in the theater. It breathes in the theater. It wouldn't translate anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And Jaco to me is one of the very few people I know and have ever had the opportunity to work with, and I knew it when I worked with him on Rodman III back in 1994. He loves theater, and he's steeped in it in a profound way that I rarely encountered anybody. Maybe Julie Taymor is one other person that I've worked with who really has a love of the theatrical craft and the vision to bring it to the stage in a way that's alive and that makes use of everything that is theatrical convention. And so when Jaco asked me about the play, if I wanted to do it, you know, come to Chicago in January, February, which of course everybody wants to come to Chicago in January. You know, the idea to work with him and to craft something and to work on something as an artist, you know, was just too good to pass up, and so we made it happen.
Yeah, we did. But I think you were probably thinking I was crazy when I suggested it the first time to come in January. Yeah. to do the play that we wanted to do. Yeah, I mean, it's not easy to do that. I mean, the great thing is that we really, I think, share a passion for the play and for this kind of work. But practical way for a small company like Tuta is with no money to bring an actor from New York, an equity actor, there's a lot of work behind that. It's not just two guys agreeing to do it, and this amazing team of people that is Tuta that supported this idea and really managed to kind of craft the environment in which this production was built is really rare, and they deserve every credit.
Jackie deserves a huge amount of credit.
Jacqueline Stone, artistic director,
who championed it and was so gracious and just an amazing glue to keep this production, to bring it here and to keep it together. It's just been such a joy to be here with her.
So Jaco mentioned something interesting, which is that he had translated a play that he did by, I think, Kovacevic did that. So I was wondering if you could talk to me about the process of getting Lagarce into English, whether there was a pre-existing translation that you chose, and also because Tuta often does European plays, what you are looking for when you pick out a translator.
That's a curse, I have to tell you, to direct translations. And it's really difficult and an important step in finding a right translation and finding a right approach to well-translated dramatic literature. It's not easy to do that. That's enormous work, and I deeply respect translation as a craft. Mm-hmm. And maybe art. So translating plays, playwrights like Lagarce or Genet or Heiner Müller, is really extra demanding. But when you're directing, and it's really trying to sense that actors can play with the language. That, to me, that's the main parameter, that it's alive, that is, that actors believe in the language. If they do, then the audience will, certainly. And so I rely a lot on actors' ears and sensibility to language. And in this translation, which I think is decent, we did have, how to say, not problems, but certain questions that we had to resolve by ourselves, because the translator was not in the room, and so we had to take...
It was probably 90% beautiful and 10% unintelligible.
Yes.
And that's understandable. You know, when you're working with Lagarce on top of... He wrote it in French, and there are so many tense issues, mm-hmm. in, you know, past tense, so many ways that the French use tense, that I'm sure for a translator, it was an Irish translator, I'm sure it must have been a nightmare to try and just get it right, and he did, for the most part, beautifully, and... for maybe one or two sections, we had to figure it out, and very occasionally just put in a word here or there, just to make it so that the audience could understand specifically what was being said. But you know, the other thing is, when you work with, I mean, Darren and Michael are such wonderful actors in their own right, that when you, it's always exciting to see. Guys like that come up against a text like this, and over the process of a couple of weeks, not only make it intelligible, because it's not the easiest text to make intelligible, but they make it their own. Like they make it, they connect to it in a way that you just believe that it's just coming out of them. That it's just and it's beautiful to watch on top of their great. Work, you know, Michael's
exactly.
dancing and that sort of stuff. It's just wonderful to. I always enjoy, because I yap a lot in that show, and it's really wonderful to sit back on the stool and watch those guys, watch these words come out of them. That is Lagarce. I mean, you hear the playwright's voice, but it's also theirs. It's also connected to them in a really beautiful way. It's exciting.
But I think it's an important. Question, the question of translation. I think that there are not, even in Chicago, which is this vibrant, exciting theater city that brings a lot of non-English dramatic literature, mm-hmm. In translation, I don't see that being done enough, mm-hmm. Because it is a difficult work, and because it is not easy to come up with a good translation. And often you have translations that are good for academia, but
yeah.
really, really not useful.
It doesn't alive. Speak well.
It's not alive.
True.
Yeah, when it's, when you speak it, it's just... it's. Dead on the page.
Yes. And that's why I kind of, you rely on actors, and sometimes it's good to do readings before the show is actually decided to be produced, just to sense the quality of translation.
And I think this piece is sort of the opposite of that. When you read it, it's easy for your mind to wander. You just don't get the depth of it. When you hear someone speaking it, it immediately start the images, everything just starts jumping off the page,
yeah.
And so I would imagine that's one of the reasons why he's not. If you put that script on most artistic directors' desks and said, "Hey, how would you like to do music hall?" They would read like 10 pages and be like, "This is mm-hmm. just unintelligible. Like, I don't get this. Whatever." Mm-hmm. So it's easy to understand why. It hasn't happened, but
that's also, I mean, part Lagarce himself was an actor, director, theater person.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not coming from literature world, from the world of literature, but he's coming from theater.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the story of music hall he lived,
mm-hmm.
And you can sense that although his plays have an enormous quality as a literature, mm-hmm. they are very practical in sense that they are wonderful plays for actors,
yeah.
And they capture something really essentially theatrical, so that a language that's only possible to use in theater.
Mm-hmm. So My last question is that in response to this play, Chris Jones had an article in the Chicago Tribune about how there are some opportunities to see avant-garde theater in Chicago. I also highly recommended Waiting for Godot at Court and Circle Machine at Oracle, and I know that Zoko has worked with Trapdoor in the past. And I'm wondering about how you get people used to plays that have that word avant-garde attached, which I think a lot of people associate with something that is very culturally specific. And if you could tell us what sort of things you've done, or rather, if somebody wants to understand that kind of work, what sort of steps they can take that will make it more comfortable for them. Because, like you said, some of these plays on the page can seem difficult.
I don't know if that word is useful anymore, frankly, avant-garde. It's a term that I don't feel attached to, and I don't feel that it speaks anymore to me. I don't know what I can do with that. I don't feel I fit where what I do fits in that. I think it more has to do with the different kind of thinking the theater is. You know, there are certain plays that are not written by formula, and they are challenging for actors, for the audiences, and I think that they are risky plays. I would say maybe that's a right word. You take enormous amount of risk to produce and stage and act in something like this, because your chances to fail are big.
Enormous.
First of all, with the audiences, who's going to come to watch it?
Yeah.
So you have to really make it good in order to attract larger attention. Mm-hmm. Because what Chris Jones calls avant-garde, what we think in this city is a theater that is doing edgier stuff and putting the plays that nobody heard of. I think that that's crucial for development of theater, that these companies exist, companies like Trapdoor, like Oracle, like Tuta.
Yes.
But that has to do with what's inside you, what you really speak about. It has not to do with the kind of movement or it really is a voice that is yours. That's how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. Rather than as a movement that actually exists, it's just a need and urge to speak, to put this place up, to communicate with the world differently. Mm-hmm.
Can I add to that? I don't know. I think you. I mean, it's just so difficult. You just try and you take a text as an actor. You just try and take a text and you try to. You try to make it live. You try to live in the moment with it, and. Make it truthful. That doesn't always mean realistic, but it means truthful. You have to find the truth of what the playwright is saying and what the director is, and through the lens of the director, try and create something that's alive and that is connected to something fundamentally human. And avant-garde approaches it just in a different way, and it's exciting for an actor because it's not so literal. It's something else. And hopefully, it's difficult, but hopefully, you know, hopefully the audience, if you view it through that lens of trying to find out what is at the core of what's being done, what's the humanity in it, mm-hmm. then I think that it'll move you. They're not avant-garde at all, but it's, and it might be a cheesy analogy, but to me it's like a lot of the Coen brothers movies. They're never really interested in plot. They're interested in theme and character. And so when you first watch a Coen brothers movie, or a number, not all of them, but a lot of them, you'll be like, you spend, because it's film, you're spending half, and film is so formulaic, you spend half the film trying to figure out what the story is. And ultimately, you can get frustrated and say, well, that's ridiculous. There's no story. And then you get to the end and you're like, I don't know if I like that movie. And then you watch it again. And because you're not looking for the formula, it's brilliant. Like what the things that they come up with and the things that they explore are just genius. And I think that's when you see good avant-garde theater, that's sort of the same thing. There's you have to detach yourself from looking for and Lugaris in the play actually kind of mocks the idea of like, well, where's the story of this? Like, where's the story? When you detach yourself from that, you there's something fundamental about the artist and about the artist's journey and about the life of the artist that he's speaking to, and that's. I think audiences are successful with it when they can detach themselves from the need of the story and see what's underneath, I guess.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you both for participating in this podcast.
Thanks for having us.
I think Music Hall is certainly a very accessible play, and it is running at the Den through March 8th and will transfer to New York at 59 E59 Theaters from March 25th until April 12th of this year. So, make sure that you take advantage of an opportunity to see it. Thank you for listening.